for diversity.
This is Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin on Ottawa's News Talk Radio 580 CFRA. The advice and recommendations in this program are for general educational purposes and not a diagnosis. You should consult a physician or health professional directly before beginning or changing any course of health treatment. You're listening to Dr. Barry Dworkin on Sunday House Call.
Welcome back. We're in conversation with Dr. William Haranick, past chair of the Cancer Advocacy Coalition of Canada and former director of cancer centers in Canada and the United States. He currently practices medical oncology with a specific interest in breast cancer. And we're talking about the 2007 report card on cancer in Canada produced by the Cancer Advocacy Coalition of Canada. And Dr. Haranick, I wanted to ask about people who have less common cancers and to define what those are, because some people may think that we're talking about something really rare, but that's not necessarily the case. They may just be not the top five cancers, but maybe the 6th to 10th most common cancers. And what happens to these people and what is available, for example, for some of the cancers that you're aware of, the treatments that are available now that can make an impact on these people's lives?
Well, we're thinking particularly of when they have less common cancers, they're less likely to have randomized trials testing treatment in their particular cases. And that encompasses two spheres of activity. Number one is young adults aged 15 to 39. Although they account for a small percentage, about 9% of the cancers total, donate in terms of years of life lost from cancer 28%, because if you die at that age, it's a blow to society. And what we found was that there was much less research in that age group, and we suspect that as a result of that, it explains why, in fact, their survival is not improving compared to young children with leukemia and so on, where the cure rate is very high, or older adults, where most of the research is done to improve survival. But in this particular group, survival is not improving. And we think that that's an area that has to be looked at, because those tumors may be quite different in that age. They look like the same tumors in the older people. The other part where people with more unusual cancers get hit is in PET scanning. PET scanning is a new technology which allows you to determine not only if a tumor, where it's placed, but whether it's alive or not, depending on how it takes up sugar. The PET scanning studies tend to be in larger groups of patients with more common tumors. And in Ontario particularly, as a matter of fact, Ontario is the laggard here, insists that you have excellent clinical data to support the use of this new technology, which is not trivial in its cost. And you're not likely to get those studies in people with less common tumors.
Right.
Those people, therefore, are bereft of access to this new technology in Ontario. In Quebec and Alberta, this is not the case. Common sense prevails and they get access because people realize there are never going to be studies in those groups.
It still strikes me as being, I'm looking for the word. I mean, normally we like to look at evidence, or at least enough evidence to convince us to do something. And if you have advisory boards and review boards in other provinces that have looked at the data and said, yes, you know, there's enough there to say that we should do that. And it's not just one province, but many provinces. As you mentioned, out west, it seems to be pretty much the way they approach things. I have difficulty understanding why there's this block here in Ontario.
I do too. In the West, there's a can-do article. In Ontario particularly, there's a can't-do emphasis, and it's a matter of attitude. In Ontario, there is a sort of a secret panel that you apply to for access to PET scanning. You don't know who they are, and there's no appeal mechanism for their consistent turn-down. In Alberta, you just sign a requisition and you get the test. I think it's the history of Ontario. I think the word stingy actually does apply.
Now, what about research and development trends? What was it that you found, again, looking at where funding goes, what is actually being studied, and the end results of this particular research?
We found 3 years ago that 70% of the money for research went for the cancer cell, study at the biologic level in the laboratory, as opposed to smaller, much smaller amounts for prevention and treatment. As a matter of fact, the amount going for behavior modification to prevent cancer from developing was about 2% of the total, whereas 60% of cancers are promoted by lifestyle issues.
Right.
So we thought there was a misallocation of research. When we looked at the data again this year, we found that 68% of the data money continues to go for basic laboratory research. And only the Cancer Society and the National Cancer Institute of Canada have increased their allocation for prevention research and treatment research, which we think is laudable. But the other agencies continue to study the offending organism, the cancer cell. Well, you know, I come from Manitoba, where many years ago we conquered Red River fever, typhoid fever, by separating sewage from water supply. We didn't
right.
study the typhoid bacillus. And malaria, of course, was killed by draining the swamps where the mosquitoes carrying the malarial parasite were breeding, not by studying the malarial parasite. But in the control of cancer, which is an epidemic of the same proportions, the studies are of the offending organism, the cancer, as opposed to the forces driving it to exist, to be born or to spread. And we think that's anomalous. I think cancer is going to be controlled with prevention research, not the laboratory research of the cancer cell.
Well, your statement reminds me of an interview I had in November with Dr. Richard Béliveau of the Molecular Medicine Lab at the University of Laval in Montreal, and who's running the Nutrinome Project, where he has said exactly as you've had. He looked from an epidemiological standpoint at cancer rates around the world and the diets that people have and what is in the foods that they're eating, the actual chemical constituents of the foods, and how they interact with the micro tumors that are in our bodies and how it prevents angiogenesis and new cell growth and such. And you're absolutely right. He had the same conclusion that about 60% of the cancers that we see today are related to foods and smoking and such of what we do to our bodies.
Absolutely. In the report card, we actually document that with Table 1 in our report on research expenditure. Yeah, you're right on. The other part of the answer to your question was with respect to clinical research, because you have to treat cancer patients with the best possible treatments. Mm-hmm. And the present system is generating at the basic laboratory level hundreds of new drugs which are targeted, and they're highly effective. I don't want to denigrate the effects of our basic researchers in generating mm-hmm. these drugs. And they're literally miracle drugs. A recent example, the Toronto Maple Leaf
got
leukemia within a few weeks. He was back taking one pill once a day.
Right.
That's a miracle to me. But these new drugs are now held up in a long queue. The bottleneck is the way we do clinical research, testing treatments. It takes 10 to 15 years to bring one of them from the lab to the clinic. And Dr. Joseph Regazza has suggested skipping one of the longest steps in there, where if you've found a highly effective drug in advanced cancer, you go straight to the early disease situation and you use it to treat the patients. You don't
right.
bother retesting it to see if it's effective in early disease. It's always effective in early disease. In early disease, then you test doses and durations, but not to see if it works. That will chop out millions of dollars of unnecessary effort, but more importantly, save thousands of lives of patients who otherwise wouldn't get it in the control arms. And he's done the calculations for this. If we had tested Herceptin in breast cancer by this method, we would have saved 50,000 mm-hmm. lives in North America, 50,000 women's lives. Had we done that with tomography, we would have saved 100,000 lives. And so on. But we continue to do this burnt earth policy type research, which we need to change.
Now, looking at again the delivery of care and along these lines, did the report look at how the Wait Times Initiative has had an impact on this? Has there been anything that you've seen as a result of this?
You know what, Barry? We've given up on that.
Yeah.
It's like pushing a string. The problem in the system is not the wait time itself, it's the lack of resources, the lack of effort, the lack of money going in to control the disease. Then the wait times are simply a reflection mm-hmm. of that. But this year, we took another tack on the issue of how patients are suffering, and we looked at supportive care. Now, I don't have to argue that supportive care is important for a cancer patient, but it's becoming increasingly evident that it may impact on survival. It certainly makes a huge difference to the quality of life and the effectiveness of the cancer survivor. And we found that We decided that nurses were probably the most important people in the healthcare system to provide supportive care. And we surveyed centers across the country and found that in about 40 of them, the nurses, although they said they were doing good supportive care by the model we were talking about, primary nursing, but in fact, in more than half, they were not able to close the loop and really provide the full service. And more importantly, we found that 32% of nursing hours across the larger cancer centers were spent nursing the clinic or nursing the doctors, but not nursing the patients, watering plants, changing linen, escorting patients to the washroom, and so on. And we think if you reallocated that time for the nurses to actually do primary nursing and navigating the patients through the silos of the healthcare system, supportive care would be greatly enhanced. And this takes a change in administrative attitudes, and on the part of the doctors, they've got to give up control.
So what recommendations from this report, what recommendations follow that, that you would say stand out? There's a lot of, we've talked about a lot of different areas, but it does seem to fall into several categories about how an appropriate approach should be taken to providing cancer care in Canada.
With respect to cancer research funding, a much greater focus on prevention. Any new monies coming in for cancer research should be focused on that, with especially behavior modification. Mm-hmm. With respect to clinical research, streamline the system that we have. With respect to cancer in young adults, invest in research in that group, and you'll get a high return in terms of potential leaders in Canada staying alive. And with respect to PET scanning, I don't know what you do in Ontario, but you have to get them to embrace modern technology. With respect to supportive care, empower nurses to nurse. And with respect to access to cancer drugs, I think an attempt has to be made to get all the players, and there's seven or eight sections that have to be dealt with in a collaborative way, to cobble together a solution to deal with this 800-pound gorilla, mm-hmm. the cost of these new miracle drugs.
Dr. Haranik, I'd like to thank you very much for taking the time to talk about this report, and I am assuming I'll be speaking to you again next year about this, about the next iteration of the report.
I hope so, Barry, and keep up the good work.
And you too. Dr. William Haranik is past chair of the Cancer Advocacy Coalition of Canada and former director of cancer centers in Canada and the United States. Practices medical oncology with a specific interest in breast cancer. Coming up, some news items, and we'll be taking your calls as well. You can start calling in at 1-800-580-2372 for our second hour, but you can call in now at 1-800-580-2372. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call.
You're listening to Dr. Barry Dworkin on Sunday House Call.